evidence from video surveillance systems. They also relied on evidence from the autopsy as well as evidence from DNA.
The state files murder charges in the death of a Kotzebue girl. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Walker Mulott campaign lodges a complaint over Republican-funded campaign ads.
They understand media and campaign disclosure requirements and have just failed to comply with them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Strongheart's Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
The state of Alaska has charged a man in the death of a 10-year-old girl in Kotzebue. This afternoon, officials announced charges against 41-year-old Peter Wilson, including murder, kidnapping, and sexual abuse of a minor. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports. A warning here, details of this story may be disturbing to some listeners.
In detailed charging documents, prosecutors with the state say that Wilson abducted Ashley Johnson Barr on a four-wheeler earlier in September, then drove her 2 miles out of town, where he allegedly raped and killed her. In total, Wilson is accused of 9 charges. Assistant Attorney General Jenna Grunstein is with the Office of Special Prosecutions.
There are 3 counts of murder in the first degree, alleging different theories of that murder, and 1 count of kidnapping, as well as 4 counts of sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree, and 1 count of tampering with physical evidence.
Originally, Wilson was charged with lying to federal agents investigating the disappearance not long after Johnson Barr's body was discovered. Prosecutors say Wilson had Johnson Barr's cell phone in his possession in the hours after she disappeared. An extensive search for the young girl conducted by community members and law enforcement in the days after she went missing turned up no results. Ultimately, geolocation data from the phone led searchers to a remote patch of tundra off a loop road out of town. The charging documents suggest Johnson Barr was strangled with her pants, and prosecutors say DNA samples taken from her body match Wilson's. Grunstein says the state's case draws on multiple layers of hard evidence.
There was obviously quite an extensive investigation that occurred in this case, and through the course of that, they were able to obtain evidence from video surveillance systems. They also relied on evidence from the autopsy as well as evidence from DNA results.
A funeral for Johnson Barr over the weekend drew hundreds of residents. Kotzebue is a small, close-knit community, and the case has gripped attention for weeks, prompting vigils, shows of support, and donations from communities across Alaska. The investigation was conducted by local police, as well as the Alaska State Troopers and agents from the FBI. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The campaign of Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mulott says a Republican-funded group failed to properly disclose that it bought political TV ads. The campaign filed a complaint today with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. It says the group Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, failed to report ads the Republican Governors Association bought in Alaska. Walker Mulott campaign manager John Henry Heckendorn says the violations are serious.
Unfortunately, it's not that hard to set up a front group that is nothing but a name on a piece of paper, effectively, to conduct your expenditures on your behalf and then hide all of your donors so no one actually has any idea where the money's really coming from.
The complaint has 2 counts. The first count says the group failed to register with the commission before spending money, which violates state law. It says the group bought $735,000 in ads with KTUU 2 months before it registered, and it never reported the money with the commission. Heckendorn says the spending is among the highest in Alaska history and is by politically savvy people.
They understand media and campaign disclosure requirements and have just failed to comply with them.
The second count says the group failed to file accurate spending reports. The Republican Governors Association initially reported that the RGA bought advertising with 7 Alaska TV stations. Then it changed the name on the contracts to Families for Alaska's Future. And that group never reported either the ads or that it benefited from the RGA's ad buy. Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, couldn't be reached for comment. The commission could fine the group if it finds a violation. there's been another airspace incursion off Alaska by Russian military planes. The North American Aerospace Defense Command identified and tracked four Russian aircraft that entered the Alaskan Air Defense Identification Zone on Friday. It was the third Russian flight through the identification zone that NORAD responded to this month, but this time it only monitored the aircraft and did not intercept them with Alaska-based U.S. fighters. A NORAD news release issued Friday says it monitored two groups of Tu-142 maritime reconnaissance and anti-submarine aircraft as they transited the zone near Alaska, which is international airspace. NORAD says the aircraft did not enter U.S. or Canadian airspace. NORAD scrambled F-22 Raptor fighter jets out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson on September 1st and again on the 11th to intercept Russian Tu-95 bombers that entered the identification zone. Facing a December 2019 deadline to substantially reduce local fine particulate pollution, the Fairbanks North Star Borough is far from achieving attainment. The borough hosted an annual air quality conference Friday and Saturday, and as KUAC's Robin reports, wood stove emissions remain a point of contention.
Wendy Mannon of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Woodburners took the microphone at the conference to tell regulators that people in our cold climate won't stop burning wood, even if their health depends on it.
How are we asking woodburners to give up the only source of heat they have so that other people aren't paying exorbitant health care costs? Because health care is so expensive, it is now the woodburners' fault because other people can't afford health care.
And health does depend on it. Jennifer Gleason-Schmidt worked for years as a nurse in Fairbanks.
Hospital admissions increase for cardiac events and strokes following a rise in PM2.5 air pollution.
Several medical studies presented at the conference showed escalating cases of respiratory, immune disorder, and inflammatory diseases due to air pollution. That's where federal regulators stepped in. In 2009, the Environmental Protection Agency found our air so thick with pollutants that it was violating the Clean Air Act. And with that designation came a 10-year timeline to clean up our air or face sanctions. This is the third year of the conference for Tim Hanlon, who works for the EPA.
The community really is moving in the direction of appreciating the challenge, wanting to rise to the challenge. My concern is, since the original designation in 2009, maybe it hasn't happened quickly enough, and my job is to help keep that going, that the Clean Air Act isn't going to go away, and that time is short.
Hamlin says he's heartened by the progress made on cleaning our air in the last decade, but we're still 2.5 times more polluted than the standards in the Clean Air Act. Wintertime monitors in North Pole have measured the highest concentration of PM2.5 in the country.
There is no doubt that control measures for wood smoke are absolutely necessary to meet the standard. Curtailment programs are not popular. They're both necessary and effective. And the problem you have here in the borough, curtailment programs help solve.
Incentives to use cleaner sources of heat, add new technologies to wood stoves, and install home and school filtration systems were endorsed by several speakers, including representatives from the Woodburners Group. Jesse Shadley of the Woodburners showed the conference that wood is the most economical fuel for home heating. The average borough homeowner pays about $500 more per year for fuel oil than firewood.
It's a tricky situation, but we have to be able to heat our homes and we have to be able to breathe. So hopefully we can all work together as a community and find a solution.
Shadley says part of that solution is the new Air Quality Stakeholders Group, where different community representatives meet monthly to discuss solutions. He says it's been helpful to reconcile trust issues that developed with the curtailment regulations. Wendy Mannon of the Woodburners Group says having a voice at the conference is also part of the solution.
The other side is not the enemy. They are just people who want to be warm, and they are just people who want to breathe clean air. We should not be okay as a community for sacrificing one to get the other. This should not be a case of one side winning and one side losing. There aren't sides.
Recordings of all the conference presentations are on the borough's air quality website, aqfairbanks.com. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the struggles of building homes on permafrost.
This shallow, warm, ice-rich permafrost with massive ice formations is one of the most difficult environments on which to construct a stable foundation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
A lot of houses in Fairbanks are built on permafrost, and there are techniques for building on that kind of ground that have been around for decades. But depending on the type of permafrost, there are unknowns about what will happen, even to those houses that have been built using best practices, as the permafrost thaws due to climate change. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this story of one homeowner for whom that concern is front and center as he builds a house on what he calls some of the worst ground in Fairbanks.
Ilya Benesh is a do-it-yourself kind of guy. He's worked in construction for close to 30 years, and for the past 10, he's been working on two large cabins, one to live in, one to rent, at the edge of a gully dotted with birch and black spruce trees.
Watch your step. This is temporary.
When Benesh bought this property back in 1999, he was pretty sure it had permafrost under it, though he didn't know for certain. But he wasn't intimidated by the idea of building on permafrost. As a carpenter, he'd already had some experience with it, and the reasons to buy the land were compelling. It was spacious, relatively cheap, and only a few minutes from his parents' house.
As I saw my parents aging, I saw a lot of value to being close by, and what was affordable in 1999 was north side of the hill property.
Benesh started building in 2008, and a few years in, he's taking the project slow, he decided to get the soil drilled to get a sense of exactly what the permafrost looked like under the surface. The news he got was bad. He read me the drill report.
This shallow, warm, ice-rich permafrost with massive ice formations is one of the most difficult environments on which to construct a stable foundation.
Oh my God.
Well, it's kind of neat to hear it after the fact.
Basically, Benesh's house is built on permafrost that's relatively close to the thawing point, which is common for Fairbanks, and is full of ice that will turn to water when it thaws. That could dramatically transform the land under his house, though he's still not exactly sure what that would look like, especially since he's on a hill.
There's not a lot of resistance to this hillside starting to slide if things thaw deep enough. I can't get a clear answer from anyone as to whether that will happen or whether the ground will just drop straight down. I don't think anybody can say.
But Benesh is perhaps one of the best people in Fairbanks to be in this position. For the past decade, he's worked as a building educator at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. That's a Fairbanks-based nonprofit that researches building strategies for Arctic environments and provides public education. What Benesh talks to homeowners and contractors about is exactly this kind of stuff. How do you build the best house you can on permafrost that's expected to thaw? One of the big things is the foundation.
So this is a steel pipe. It's 6 inches in diameter, and it goes down about 40 feet into the permafrost.
Building on pilings is a common approach for constructing on permafrost. They anchor the house and loft it up so it doesn't warm the ground underneath. When Benesh started building, he knew that 40 feet was the typical depth for pilings, so he went with that.
What I know now is I probably should have driven to 60 feet.
That's really deep. He's since retrofitted two additional 60-foot pilings that will be able to support the house if the others fail. Aside from the foundation, Benesh has given a lot of thought to how to protect the ground and keep the permafrost cold. He'll have a large wraparound porch to keep the foundation shaded and a continuous gutter around the roof that empties 25 feet into the gully to prevent any erosion or water from getting in the pilings. He's also doing his best not to disturb the moss and trees around the house, which provide shade and insulation for the ground. He's even adding to them.
I've actually planted Siberian larches. There's about 22 of them right now.
All these measures are standard for people who are building on permafrost and want to make sure the house itself doesn't cause the permafrost to thaw. But they're also just the simplest and most affordable tools in the toolbox when it comes to stalling thaw due to rising temperatures. Benesh knows that they won't stop it in the long run, but he hopes they'll be enough, at least for his lifetime and even beyond it. He's 49 now.
I'm not afraid of a challenge, but the not knowing what this area is going to do in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, it makes me uneasy.
If Benesch had the chance to go back to 1999 and buy a different piece of property, would he? Yeah, he says, he would. It would save him a lot of time and some sleepless nights. But he says that for anyone determined to build on permafrost themselves, he has a few suggestions. Build small, get educated on best practices, and make sure to get the drill testing done before you start. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Governor Bill Walker signed an administrative order yesterday in Juneau recognizing and declaring a linguistic emergency for 20 Alaska Native languages. The order recognizes the threat faced by Alaska Native languages and takes steps to revitalize, restore, and preserve them by directing state agencies to work directly with tribal partners. It also directs the state to use traditional Alaska Native place names on public signage whenever possible. The signing took place at the First Alaskans Institute Social Justice Summit, which kicked off Sunday with a public warming of the hands ceremony. The order directs the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development to address recommendations from the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council and come back with a full report by next June. The council was created in 2012 to advise the governor and legislature on ways to prevent the loss of Alaska Native languages. In a report this year, the council warned that all 20 languages are at risk of extinction by the end of this century. In 2014, the legislature passed a law recognizing 20 indigenous languages as official state languages, making Alaska the second U.S. state to do so. The State Department of Education will pick Alaska's Teacher of the Year next month. This week, we'll have profiles of each of the five finalists from across the state. The first is Ingrid Cumberledge, a third-grade teacher from Sandpoint. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, Cumberledge has taught in the Aleutians East Borough School District for more than 20 years, and her Sandpoint roots run deep.
Ingrid Cumberledge has always lived in Alaska. She grew up in Sandpoint and went to college in Fairbanks and Anchorage. She didn't always know she was going to be a teacher.
I went to school for political science, and I actually worked in the legislature for a short amount of time. And then I realized, you know, I love working with kids. And they pay you to play with kids, and to watch kids get excited about learning is the best thing in the world.
Despite getting a taste of more urban Alaska, Cumberledge always knew she was going to come back home and serve her community. She says her parents were big influences in that decision.
They helped establish the borough out there. They fought for the first municipal school district, and then they fought for the borough school district. They later fought for the health, the local health agency. And so I had these really great models. And so to be able to go back to my hometown and teach just was the ultimate goal, because I could give back to those kids.
Cumberledge taught high school before third grade, and she says she prefers teaching the younger kids.
Third grade is pretty amazing because they go from being spoon-fed, you know, needing a lot of help and support when they come in, to being pretty independent learners. And they're willing to try anything at third grade.
When announcing the nominees for Teacher of the Year, the Department of Education highlighted Cumberledge's status as a community and cultural advocate. Not only does she work hard to create relationships with parents, but she also takes advantage of the rural landscape of Sandpoint to teach her students about history, culture, and science.
We get to talk about how people lived traditionally and insulated their homes. And in our region, that means the Bravaras, so they were half semi-subterranean with hills built above them so that it washed off the rain. And we get to compare that to modern-day insulation and modern-day construction with the 200-mile-an-hour winds that blow through occasionally.
Cumberledge is the only nominee this year who was born in Alaska, and she's proud to represent her community.
I do appreciate the opportunity to celebrate Alaska teachers coming from Alaska, particularly from rural Alaska, Alaska Native teachers being celebrated. I think we have a lot of great teachers that are teaching all over Alaska.
And Cumberledge says she's happy she's able to put her small community of about 1,000 in the spotlight. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, Ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The same day Petersburg's post office was shut down 2 weeks ago with a hazardous materials spill, the Petersburg Medical Center was treating an outbreak of influenza among passengers and employees on a cruise ship docked there. Hospital officials say it was an early warning about the upcoming flu season. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
One of the last ships to call in Petersburg this season, the American Constellation, was in port Thursday, September 13th. The Petersburg Medical Center's infection control director, Liz Bacom, says the local hospital that day started seeing both passengers and crew from the ship.
So the first patient came in through the emergency room, and this patient was worked up for upper respiratory pneumonia, possibly lower respiratory. And then after that, shortly thereafter, we were getting calls of for appointments for the clinic to see more of the cruise ship passengers and employees. And because the physicians work really well together, they talk amongst each other, hey, I've got this case or that case. And they were able to say, you know, this almost looks like flu. Let's investigate a little bit further.
Bacom hadn't heard of other flu in Alaska from regular reports she receives from the state. However, some of the patients did test positive for flu, prompting the hospital to vaccinate its own employees and contact the ship to let them know. Samples were also sent off for testing at the state's public health lab in Fairbanks. The ship's next port of call, Wrangell, was also notified. Physician Mark Tosillo says symptoms of this strain of flu are different from viruses that hit last year.
This is actually more typical than what we saw last year, which didn't have a fever, didn't have red eyes, didn't have the whole constellation of things we usually base that on. So, you know, luckily Dr. Heyer took a look and said, no, this looks like flu. Red eyes, runny nose, headache, nausea, fevers, night sweats.
The federal government's Centers for Disease Control starts counting cases in October, and because of that, that's sometimes thought of as the start of the flu season. The vaccine also goes out to healthcare providers in the fall. Last year's season in Alaska got off to an early start, and it did send people to the hospital here in Petersburg. This year, most in the community have yet to have a flu shot, and there was some concern over exposure of community members. The medical center representatives say the cases from the cruise ship are an early reminder that flu season is on its way and are taking the opportunity to repeat their recommendation to get a flu shot. Again, here's Bacom.
Of course, last year we all know the vaccine wasn't as great as we would have liked. It never is 100%. It's kind of like you need to do the belt and suspenders kind of thing. Even though you got the flu shot, you still need to be careful with high contact areas and washing your hands and all that stuff to keep yourself from getting sick.
The hospital has received the new vaccine, and officials there expect to be offering it to the public at shot clinics in the near future. People can also schedule an appointment. The American Constellation is owned by American Cruise Lines. The company did not respond to requests for comment on the flu cases. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
The city of Sitka is sending residents who have damage claims resulting from a recent power surge directly to the contractor's insurance company. At least 50 homes are known to have experienced appliance failures, mostly in heat pumps, after a utility contractor snapped a guy wire, creating a short between the city's high-voltage transmission lines and lower-voltage distribution lines. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka Utility Director Brian Bertacci says electric grids in Alaska experience faults all the time, usually from downed tree branches or from rodents or birds on the wires, and they're cleared before customers are aware of any problems. But the recent fault in Sitka was a different animal altogether.
In this case, it was a steel cable of large diameter, so you got a really, I guess in one, you could characterize it in one way as a really good fault, right? But in a bad way, it was a really good fault, right? So a lot of a very short duration, you know, probably less than half a second that fault occurred before the protection worked to clear it, but still significant high voltage levels likely to a lot of the community.
The guy wire was broken by a utility contractor involved in an extensive water and sewer replacement under DeGroff Street at the intersection of Sawmill Creek Road. The latter is Sitka's utility corridor carrying the 69,000-volt transmission lines from Sitka's hydroelectric projects into town. Below the three transmission lines is the local distribution line. When the guy wire snapped, it connected the high and low voltage lines, briefly sending an estimated 3 to 6 times more voltage to customers than normal, and apparently creating a show.
And I think folks that were nearby saw quite a shower of sparks.
Power was out for about 4 hours after the fault. Once electricity was restored, people began to notice problems. Sitka Municipal Administrator Keith Brady says that City Hall has logged calls from 48 residents so far whose home appliances may have been damaged by the surge. He says much depends on what was turned on at the time of the fault. One appliance in particular, though, seemed especially susceptible to problems.
You know, outside of water heaters, stoves, coffee makers, microwaves, the big livability problem we have is the heat pump. So it sounds like we have a lot of heat pump damage around town, and we want to make sure that people can live in their homes, you know, in the winter. So we want to make sure that this gets moved as quickly as possible.
Utility companies are generally not liable for acts of God that damage property, but a contractor backing into a support pole doesn't fall under that exclusion. City Hall is directing all claims toward the contractor's insurance company, Alaska Adjusters LLC. A claim number has been established for damage connected to the incident. The city at the moment can only speculate about why the outage was hard on heat pumps and why it was hard on only some of them. The geographic distribution of failures doesn't really provide a clue. Bertacci suspects it might have to do with which of Sitka's three-phase transmission wires was first contacted by the broken guy wire, although it ended up wrapped around all three. Sitka Community Affairs Director Megan Bozak says anyone planning to file an insurance claim from the surge should be prepared to document the damage. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Tim Ellis, Robin and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Did you know there's no safe amount of alcohol to drink while pregnant? But why should this matter if you're not pregnant or not trying to be? Because nearly half of all pregnancies are unplanned. Many women don't know they're pregnant right away. You could get pregnant and expose your baby to alcohol even before you know you're pregnant. If you're having unprotected sex, don't drink. Learn how FASDs impact everyone, even you, at letstalkfasdak.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.